Good afternoon, and the last session of the last day of 6 days of extraordinary talk, conversation, listening, laughing, sometimes being moved, but I think it's just been absolutely wonderful. And it's wonderful in part, in large part, because the audiences, you, have been absolutely fantastic in your courtesy, civility, respect, listening and engagement with what we've been hearing from a cast of thousands. Now, someone who I need to talk to is leaving, and I'm really annoyed. Talia, get back here, please. Sorry, don't talk to my colleagues like that normally, but they're so hard to get to sort of obey instructions. Say you stay there, Talia. So I'm not going to take much time. So we've come to the close of another year, so I just want to say a few words. The festival, as I said, over 6 days brings over 200 riders to the gardens. The logistics are complex and require lots of planning and dedication for colleagues who are passionate and professional. I want to pay particular tribute first and foremost, and can I see her? Is she there? She's over there. See, that's exactly what I'm talking about. So professional. We have had a secret pact here to try and get Suzanne Critchley, who's our program manager, to be here for 2 minutes. And have we got her? No, we have not yet got her. Circle back. Can't circle back. I've got to go forward, fast forwarding. Anyway, so Suzanne Critchley, who's my co-conspirator, hand in glove we work to make this festival work. There she is, finally. Finally. So I'm sorry. So I cannot describe the list of tasks that Suzanne takes on, all the while ensuring that the experience for our writers and our audience is seamless. Suzanne has been wonderfully supported by Katya and Tony, and I just want to get you to give them a round of applause, and Kitty, because it would not be possible without Suzanne Critchley and her team. No. Everyone in the audience will have met our wonderful team of volunteers who, despite heat or rain, remain friendly and helpful. I couldn't be more touched by the dedication they have to the work we do and their engagement. Our production team, headed up by Taryn, are tech wonders. All the people you see here in that bank of computers and desks and things like that, and the wonderful Alira, have provided, I think they have the best bedside manner in the business, and they keep us calm. They are superbly supportive and encouraging of the writers and moderators on stage. It's, I think, an immaculate experience from my humble opinion, and it is due to the wonderful tech supporters we have in stage managers. So please, a thank you to them. And finally, to my colleagues, the CEO, Kath Mainland, and Artistic Director, Ruth McKenzie. They are also my co-conspirators, my allies, my friends, and my sisters, and my heartfelt thanks to them too. So we're closing Writers Week for 24 with this session. My worries are already turning to 25, and I'm looking forward to seeing you all in March of 2025. But thank you so much for all your support. Thank you.
Well, before Louise marches off, I think we should all just put our hands together for an absolutely spectacular Writers Week. So everyone, thank you so much for being here this evening and braving the heat for what is not a particularly hospitable Adelaide afternoon, but it's a credit to this festival that you're all here this afternoon. My name's Sarah Martin, I'm a journalist with Guardian Australia, and I'm here with Kate Morton, one of Australia's most loved authors, a New York Times best-selling author, and we're here to talk about her seventh novel, Homecoming. Before we start, I'd just like to acknowledge that the land we meet on today is the traditional land for the Kaurna people, and we respect their spiritual relationship with their country. We also acknowledge the Kaurna people as the custodians of the Adelaide region, and that their cultural and heritage beliefs are still as important to the living Kaurna people today. So let's dive on in, because, Kate, this was not the seventh novel that you initially planned to write, is it?
It wasn't, and thank you. I'll just jump in and say thank you, everyone, for being here as well. And Sarah, it's lovely to speak with you. This was not the book that I imagined I was going to write for my seventh novel. If I can rewind back to 2019, 2020, I was living in London with my family. I'd published The Clockmaker's Daughter, and I'd started work. I'd been working for about a year on what was going to be my seventh novel. It was set in Europe, and I'd written about 20, 30,000 words. I'd done lots of research, and I had research trips planned. And then word started to circulate about this strange new virus. And before I knew it, 2020 rolled on. And we, you know, the way expats do, we had a return trip to Australia booked for Easter. And we thought, it was sort of day by day, we thought, I think we should probably take the flight now, just in case, you know, flights are starting to be cancelled. Let's go now. And then I have three sons, their schools went online. And we thought, let's go now. We'll come back at the end of the term when it's all over and get on with life. So back we flew on the strangest... I mean, long-haul flying is strange regardless. But at the beginning of a pandemic, it's really strange. As I say, we went through Singapore and flights were coming off the board. It was mid-March, four-year anniversary coming up for our short trip home to Australia, which is ongoing. Flights being cancelled, people in hazmat and with thermometers. I mean, I don't want to re-traumatise everybody, but you can remember. And then we landed back here, caught a taxi up to a farm in the Adelaide Hills. And I cannot... perhaps you can imagine how strange that difference was to go from the grey grim of March, late sort of wintry London, and then to land here on a day like this with the roses with their big heavy heads and the heat and the clarity of the light was so different. And so I thought, well, okay, we're here for a little while. But of course, to cut a long story short, the little while became a much longer while and children had to go back to school. And here we are, 4 years later. And in the meantime, I tried to stay connected to this book that I was writing. But it was like I kept thinking about that there's a line in T.S. Eliot, "The Still Point of the Turning World." That's where I felt I was, standing in this hot, hazy, you know, late summer Adelaide Hills, trying to reconnect with this book that I'd been writing only weeks before in you know, urban Europe, felt so distant, not just geographically, but emotionally, psychologically. And instead, everything, I think this happens in times of, I guess, heightened events. Your senses heighten too. And so the landscape really re-imprinted on me. And I just felt this really compelled to write a story set in the place that I had found myself. And because we had to quarantine for 2 weeks, we were doing these walks around the farm through the dry creek beds where the wattles grow. And these images that, if anyone has read Homecoming, will be quite familiar to you, really were drawn directly from my real life. They just sort of begged, they made their way into the story. And so that became the seventh book, Homecoming.
And I want to come to your portrayal of the landscape in the book, which is just delightful. But just take me back to, I guess, that discombobulation you had when you were... because you're the six and a half novel, if we can call it. That was a World War II novel, is that right? So how long did you persist with that, and at what point did you decide to change tack completely?
I tried for quite some time because... you know, I'm a writer. That's what I do. I have a contract for the book, and the professional thing would be to front up and not wait for the muse to attend and keep trying. And I did that, but it's a fine balance between being professional and not waiting for the muse to attend, but also knowing that the book that you're writing has to have a spark of life in it. And when that spark isn't there, I know from experience that what I produce, it might hold up as a book, but it won't have that that living, breathing essence that I think readers connect with. And I could just feel that I had lost that the flame had gone out. And that would be a huge problem if not for these other images and ideas that were starting to come together. And as that happens, it's actually, for me, the most wonderful part of being a novelist is that period at the beginning when all sorts of little idea fragments start to come together and alchemize, and it's like the conjuring of something that really happened, and it becomes so vivid that there isn't really a choice. It's not something that I made up. It feels like something that I can remember having happened. Mm. And I could feel that with the new idea. And thank goodness for that, I was able to put the other aside. And I have now pulled it out again. So I've managed to reanimate the flame. Okay. But for this particular book, where home and belonging and identity and place was so much at the forefront of my mind, it was the right book at the right time.
And having that experience of sort of the pandemic enclosing around you and being very isolated, I imagine, in your new Adelaide Hills locale, how did that sort of play out? I mean, did it make you look at your landscape differently? Did it change your sense of place?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's true for all of us, that your senses do... it's like someone tightens or strengthens the focus on your senses when you are in a time of great change. It's hard to think back now, but if you can recall the beginning of 2020, things were changing on the daily. You know, we all switch the news on and there would be new information, and you have to stay alert when that sort of thing is happening in your world. Then the old rhythms and routines fall away, and instead you become hyper-focused on the here and now. And I felt, I mean, what we do as humans, but certainly as writers of any kind of artist whose job it is to take the real world and turn it into, you know, another story form, you rely upon your senses. I mean, that's the palette with which we have to work. And so when those are switched up and that focus is tightened, you suddenly... I found that I could see things that were commonplace to me, like my own home landscape, I could see it through fresh eyes. And I loved that because as an Australian who has written a lot about in settings in the UK, where I have felt I had that advantage of being able to look at things with an outsider's eyes, I had that strange feeling of being able to see my own landscape with more outside eyes as well. And that was actually, it was a real pleasure and privilege, I think. Yes. It's always nice to be reminded of how beautiful, strange, whatever the world around you is. Mm.
And the story you know, follows that homecoming journey of Jess and returning to Australia after, you know, being a struggling journalist in London, and she decides to tackle her own sort of, well, the family secret that she uncovers. It's interesting to me that throughout the process of you writing this novel, obviously your sense of home must have changed as well to decide to stay here. So can you talk us through that and how that sort of played into your writing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Jess, my contemporary character, because for anyone who hasn't read Homecoming, it follows as... It has, in common with my other books, it has multiple timelines, one in the past and one in the present. And Jess is the present day character, and she has probably more biographically in common with me than many of my other characters, insofar as she was also an expat Australian living in London, though she had been there for 20 years. I had only been there for 5. And she's called back to Australia unexpectedly when her beloved grandmother, who is more like a mother than a grandmother in that she raised Jess when her own mother was unable to do so. And she has had an injury and been taken to hospital, and Jess has to make the decision that all expats, I think, fear they will experience, it, getting that call and having to get on a plane and do that 24-hour flight to get back to the people or the person who you love. So she does that and finds herself back in Australia, experiencing very similar things to that which I experienced of the brightness of the light. I mean, you're all familiar with that feeling, I'm sure, of how bright it is. I think I read once that a photographer said that it was 2 f-stops overexposed in Australia. But so Jess experiences that and sees her place anew and experiences that that thing that I think most expats or anyone who's lived in more than one country or loved more than one country, perhaps even more than one city, it's that it's a gift to get to have that experience, but it's also signing yourself up for a sense of permanent dislocation, in that whenever you're in one, you yearn in some way for the life that you have in the other. And that is just something that has to be balanced. And so Jess does experience that.
Is it a 40-degree day in Adelaide where you feel the tug of London?
Yeah, maybe. Certainly lands of extreme.
Yeah. I guess, you know, you the novel, as you say, it traverses different times, it traverses different places. I was really fascinated in your descriptions of Darling House as well in Sydney, and I wanted to ask you if that was from one of your experiences. How did you draw inspiration for Nora and also Darling House, which is so beautifully captured in the novel?
Oh, I'm glad. Houses are my thing. I love them. I always have. I'm not sure where it comes from, but I sometimes, if I think back, when I was a child, my parents did love to take us to open houses to look on weekends. So, and my mum used to sit up in bed drawing house plans for pleasure. So I think that awareness of the house as a space, which becomes a repository for memories and human lives, are led within, you know, those walls. That sense has always been with me. And of course I love beautiful old houses and houses with secrets. Mm. Perhaps that's the Gothic bent that I have. You know, give me a house with an under the stair closet and an attic and secret rooms and filigree. Yes, please. So, short, you know, I can't acquire houses everywhere, so I get to invent them instead. Mm. And it is one of the best parts of my writing life, is coming up with houses in which to place my people and have their lives unfold. So Darling House is in Sydney, and I was thinking very much of houses like Vaucluse. Mm-hmm. House. It is an invention, but I really loved getting to draw a house. I gave it a more subtropical environment than it would perhaps really have, because I grew up in the subtropics. And so that is, I think, your childhood environment imprints upon you. And for me, I don't enjoy the subtropics, but it's a part of me. And so I did enjoy giving Jess a lot of my childhood memories, like sneaking out into the subtropical garden and finding somewhere underneath the fern fronds to hide away with a book. That is directly from my life. And it contrasted very much with the house in the Adelaide Hills part of the book, which I based very much on Martindale Hall. Mm-hmm. Certainly the internals, and that sense of this, in the same way characters and people can be displaced, I think that's what's quite starkly beautiful about a house like Martindale Hall. Mm. Seeing something that's almost a Georgian replica sitting in the middle of the Australian landscape, there's that sense of that frisson of displacement.
Were you able to visit as you were writing during the pandemic, or how did you?
I was. Yeah. I had never been, but I had heard rumours. I heard tell of this beautiful old English-style house in the Clare Valley with a sort of tragic secret attached. Mm. And if you know me, I hear that and I have to go there. So in 2020, I think it was in about May when we were allowed to leave in small groups, we took a family road trip up to the Clare Valley. Mm-hmm. And it was a funny thing, because I'm sure many of you have been to Martindale Hall, but we drove and arrived, and to see this perfect Georgian house in that landscape was so surreal. And we went inside, and I felt this real sense of familiarity. And it wasn't until I was in the nursery and saw the little plaque saying that Picnic at Hanging Rock had mm-hmm. been filmed inside the room that I thought, oh, I wonder if whether it's that or that sort of story is familiar. But it did have that familiarity.
Mm. I mean, as I'm sure anyone in the audience who's read the book will appreciate, there is... You know, you have this town Tambilla in the novel, and I found myself trying to work out, is that Uraidla, is that Harndorf? Can you tell us about Tambilla and whether or not that is based on an actual place, or if it's sort of an amalgamation of all these places in the hills?
It is an amalgamation, but it's it's between Verdun, Balhanna and Harndorf. If you triangulated, that's where the setting of the book takes place. And, I mean, Harndorf features, obviously. And I did quite a lot of research on Harndorf and the original layout in the along very traditional German lines, and gave that to my village of Tambila as well.
And had you looked at the landscape here in that way before? Was that a first for you?
In terms of writing, putting it in a book, I've always loved it. I love that fusion of the, you know, beautiful, stark Australian gum trees of, you know, the sort familiar from like a Hans Heisen painting, but then the very, very European gardens, and that fusion is always of interest to me. But perhaps because I was, when I was in Australia, I would set books in England, and I hadn't got up to the, you know, I always had one book ahead to write, so I hadn't reached the point of putting it in a book, but I was so glad to get to do it. And it's wonderful to hear from readers who've never been to Australia who are able to experience it in that way.
And I love the way you sort of captured the sort of subtle differences between that natural environment in Sydney and in Adelaide, and the sort of, I guess you could kind of feel the landscape that you portrayed.
I hope so. I mean, that's good to hear, because that's hard to explain to people who aren't familiar with Australia too, just how vast it is and how varied our different areas are. You know, the subtropics are vastly different from here.
So your novels often sort of based around the theme of a secret. It's kind of a bit of a whodunit feel to the books of yours that I have read. Where does this fascination with secrets come from?
I mean, surely everybody loves secrets. I mean, you know, what's not to like? It's the thing people won't tell you. I mean, doesn't that immediately make it something you need to know? Also, I grew up reading mysteries. I collected my own set of Enid Blyton books, Trixie Belden books, Famous Five. I loved mystery. And so that was my first love as a reader. And I think, I mean, secrets are inherent to mystery books. It's you're discovering the unknown. But Perhaps it's an extension of my love of houses, and a type of house is a family, you know, the family line. Families, secrets are inherent within families. Whenever you get a group of people who are closely bonded and related, you're going to find secrets. And, you know, I used to, you know, I always say that every family has secrets, and every so often someone will say, well, no, mine doesn't. And I always think, well, you just don't know.
Very well kept secrets, yeah, indeed.
Exactly. And, I mean, people, thankfully, are always eager to tell me their family secrets, which I never discourage, by the way, or never discourage.
So the character in The Lake House who hides the volumes of Sherlock Holmes in her drawers, that's you as a young girl, is that right?
For sure.
Yeah, okay. And I do love there's a lot of literary references in your novels, and I think it really shows a real passion for reading that you have obviously always had.
Yeah.
Which, and we'll come back to the novel in a minute, I'm just curious to know which authors inspire you now. Do you still go back to those old favourites, or...?
I'm super eclectic, and again, I think I might have got that from my mum, who never, I can't picture my mum when I was growing up without a book in hand. So, and we read everything. Mum was an antique dealer, and so we had a lot of secondhand books come into our house. And so I often read a book without even really, and this is a terrible thing for an author to say, without even looking what the title or the author's name was. It was just a book. And so it would be read. Today I love fiction, and I actually read more and more nonfiction. I think that's probably a result of the world in which we live and how much there is to feel that we need to know about to sort of curb our anxieties. But in terms of fiction, I love Kate Atkinson, all the usual suspects. I love books with houses in them. Sarah Waters, I used to love passionately Barbara Vine. Mm-hmm. And I only say used to because obviously there are no new Barbara Vine books, but she was the first author I read who had written as Ruth Rendell. And then I picked up, I'll tell you this story. My mum used to always say, you have to read Ruth Rendell. You'll love Ruth Rendell. And I would say, I was about 17, 18. I was like, I'm not going to read Ruth Rendell. That's for old people. Gosh. So I wouldn't pick up Ruth Rendell. And then one day, a few years later, I'd been in a bookstore and there was a table, you know, of miscellaneous books. And I'd picked up one called The Chimney Sweeper's Boy by Barbara Vine. And I read it and I fell in love with this author. Mm-hmm. And I was so happy to be able to take an author back to my mom and say, mm-hmm. I found a new author. Barbara Vine, you're going to love her. And you can imagine the enjoyment she must have felt in being able to say, yeah, she's good, isn't she? It's Ruth Rendell.
Yeah. Fantastic. I was asking Kate before the session if, because obviously there's this incredible Adelaide Hills community of writers with Hannah Kent and Pip Williams and Jane Coetzee, and I asked if they caught up or, you know, if they had a book club that they were part of, and apparently not, but I just think it's a secret book club.
That's first rule of book club.
Yeah, exactly. okay, so we'll just go back to the novel, and there's obviously this fantastic sense of place and home, and but also there's, you know, some very significant themes of loss and motherhood, and you know, the ties that bind families together. Tell me why. I mean, obviously this could have just been a straight sort of crime novel, whodunit novel, but obviously you chose to weave in all those other themes. Tell me about why that was important to you to bring those into this story.
You know, I often think, and certainly this, I suppose I should only speak for myself, but an author's genre, an author's themes, I think choose the author rather than the other way around. Because even when I set out and I say, this time I'm going to write a really streamlined novel, I'm not going to have all of those backstories, it's just going to be the meat of the story. And I start and I write a scene or a chapter and then I say, I'm just going to go into the childhood of that character. I think it's important.
Yeah.
So these things always end up happening. These are the themes that I don't seem ever to be able to write myself free of. Mm. You know, identity, family, maternity, the very gothic themes, actually. Mm. Houses entrap. You know, is a house, it's a place of safety, but it can also be a place of entrapment, as we see it with my character, Isabel. But more than anything else, my favourite theme, and the one that I will never, ever tire of writing about, is that I love the past and I love history, but what I really love is the moment that the past and the present are tethered together. Mm. Because for me, I don't know why, but I have always been aware that time is not linear and these things are with us in layers all the time. T.S. Eliot is my favourite poet, probably for that reason. I find so much to relate to in his poetry, and always have since being a teenager. So these things come up over and over again. I've only ever been a published writer since I became a mother, so I suppose that's why issues of maternity rear their heads so often. And with Homecoming, I was conscious from the beginning that I wanted to write some characters who we meet in chapter one, and we form a view, and then halfway through the book, for various reasons, we come to see them from a different perspective. Because that's something else that interests me, is storytelling and the way we have to rely on the stories we're told in order to form our impression of the world and what's happening in it. And it just so happens now I can look, and I don't know whether I intended it or not, but it's certainly me-ish. The women who we meet, there's a real sense that some of them are good mothers and some of them are bad mothers. Mm. And as we read the book and we reach the midpoint, we start to see that maybe those judgments are a little less binary than we might have been led to believe at the beginning.
Mm. And this really sort of draws on the experience of Isabel as a mother and her experience at the centre of this family tragedy. Tell us about how you formed Isabel as a character.
I really liked writing Isabel. So in the historical storyline, the story revolves around a terrible crime that we know about from the beginning, and we discover it within the first chapter. And it's one of those sort of culture-changing events, similar to things like the Somerton Man, those sorts of events that happen, and the whole of society knows about it. So it's one of those sorts of crimes. A true crime novel is written about it, which we see in Homecoming, because there happens to be an American journalist on hand in the Adelaide Hills in 1959 who's available to write the story. So we read that as well. And that's how we learn. That's how we see most of Isabel is through Daniel Miller's book. She is a character who's English, and so it's sort of the reverse of Jess's story. She, at the end of the Second World War, marries an Australian who has big sort of nationalistic dreams about going back and buying a farm in Australia and making good. And so he brings his English wife back, and she has a number of children, and then he's off starting new businesses and has left her in this beautiful big house quite alone. And so she, as I was saying before, is a really good example of someone for whom her house, while it's beautiful, is also quite entrapping. And she has that feeling of being an outsider. She's had her children and they are little Australian children, and she feels very foreign from them, which I found really interesting to write about. I haven't had that experience, but I could well imagine what that must be like, because it's sharing aspects of your own childhood with your children is quite a natural part of the continuity of parenthood. And so I could imagine what it would be like if your children were growing up somewhere vastly different from where you had that slight barrier, even though you had grown them and they were of you, there would be that slight barrier. And I find that sort of thing, that tension, interesting to write about.
Did you not have any sense of isolation, which I think is really Isabel's experience when she's in that house, but having come back in the middle of a pandemic to an isolated house in the Adelaide Hills, was that not part of your experience?
Definitely. Mm. It was super isolating. Mm. I mean, we were all isolated, right? But to change, I mean, we walked out the door of our house in London thinking we'd be gone for maybe a month or two, and we didn't go back. Mm. I mean, that is a very strange thing to experience. New schools had to be found, all of that sort of thing. But to rewind back, it was super isolating, and we had to do the 2 weeks of quarantine, and we didn't have a local community because it's not where we had lived before we went to London. That's Brisbane. So it was very strange. Thankfully, I do well with isolation. So on a personal level, I was fine. That's, you know, I choose to work alone with imaginary people most of the time. And my family, I should say, my family are all in Adelaide, my two sisters and my mum and my niece and nephew. And, you know, I have noisy children. And so there was a lot going on as well.
Even if you couldn't have them all over at the same time.
No, only 10. And there were 11 of us.
Oh, no, that's awkward. Musical chairs or something. Okay, and so may I ask, what has kept you here?
Well, I mean,
apart from the 10, you know, wonderful relatives, I'm sure. Yeah,
exactly. They're definitely a large part. Yeah. You know, I used to be much more of a sort of, you know, planner and manager, but I have learned as I've got older to be as the river and go with the flow. And there was so much that you couldn't control in the pandemic. I mean, for one thing, it's hard to remember now, but you weren't actually allowed to leave with any certainty that you'd be able to come back again. So, I mean, that's problematic when you have family in Australia. And so we stayed, and I think it must have been the ages of my children as well, because my eldest was in year 11. Mm-hmm. So I should tell you, to add to the surreal experience we were having when we came back from London, and the boys had online school. They continued to do that until the middle of the year, and it meant logging on at 6 p.m. and logging off at midnight. So we were living a completely topsy-turvy, disconnected, strange existence. But I think, I mean, we all were, right? Even if you were in the house that you always lived in, everybody experienced that discombobulation to some extent or another.
Yeah, absolutely. Kate, your novels are so sort of masterfully plotted, but they're also incredibly detailed, and particularly as you sort of traverse time and place. And I'm interested to know about your process of research, because you say you read a lot of nonfiction, but there's a huge amount of work that goes into, particularly when you've obviously had settings in war, you've had settings in various countries. Tell us about your sort of research process that underpins the novels.
Oh, I love the research part. So. Because I have been so lucky that the first novel I wrote that was picked up for publication was... I had already written a couple of manuscripts that had not been... they weren't successfully published. And I'd been really trying to... I looked at some mystery books that I liked, and I had really tried to work out the template and how it was done and to produce something similar. And by the time I started writing The Shifting Fog, I'd just had my first baby. My world was completely different.
Foggy.
Very foggy. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I thought, well, I'm not going to be a published author, but I love and I cannot stop doing this. So do you know what? Genre doesn't matter. I'm just going to write a list of all the things I love, and I'm going to throw them into a book. And it will just be something I do for the pleasure and to have somewhere to go, because... books for me, as readers and as writers, they are places that we go, right? And I needed that in that hour and 20 minutes, if I was lucky, that my baby would sleep during the day. I just wanted to go into this world. And so I wrote something. I still don't know what genre it is, really. It's got a bit of everything in it. It was purely something I loved. And I'm so lucky that that's what was published in the end, because it means I still get to write what I love. So I pick a research topic, something that fascinates me and that I would read about anyway. And because I have quite obsessive nature when it comes to knowledge and its acquisition, I read everything. And all of a sudden, antenna go up, and anything I might be able to see or watch or hear, everything starts to relate to the book that I'm working on. And it is just this pure pleasure to get to indulge this love for whatever topic it might be. And I collect information, and as I'm doing that, simultaneously the fiction part of it starts to come together, and I start to see what the world looks like and the colour and the room and the people. And then little snippets of conversation come, I don't know where from, but I collect them, and they're all in there, and it builds and builds, and it starts to feel like this anxiety of I can't hold it all anymore, and I scribble things down, but it's all in here as well. And that's the point when it's like, I have to start writing this down, and nothing can happen to me until I'm finished this book, because it needs to get out. And it really is this most pleasurable, painful anxiety and enjoyment all mixed in together. And I love that. And I keep researching along the way, because it's like each book, it really is a time capsule of your life in the period in which it took to write it. And everything starts to relate. And life and writing become this sort of osmotic entity. And that's the only way I know how to do it. So I'm lucky that I love that part.
I feel like I should get your family up here and ask them how that process is.
Yeah, it's lovely for them. They love it. Yeah. My husband, for a long time, wrote music for film projects. And so everything worked great in our house until we were both working on something at the same time. Mm-hmm. And when two parents are sort of walking around into walls, that's when the wheels come off.
Well, it sounds... How long does it take you to write a novel? Because they are so detailed.
Yeah, it's... for a while, I did them every couple of years, but 3 years between is better, because it takes a while to shed the old obsessions, I suppose, and the old world, and to really fully, because I'm very monogamous with it, to fully enter the new world. It is like creating a bubble and living inside it, and then when it's finished and it seals, only then can that one go off and the new one can start.
Kate Grenville in a session the other day was saying when she's writing, she has to trick herself that no one's ever going to read it. So there's sort of this process of, you know, writing with the door closed, or, you know, how do you find that process? Are you thinking of your audience when you write, or are you kidding yourself that it's never going to see the light of day?
Neither. It's because it becomes so much something that I am I'm so invested in it, and I'm in the world, and it's happening, and it's so satisfying to have. Because when I am working, the writing is my least favorite part, I mm-hmm. should say, because it's the work, and I am really rigorous. I'll write mm-hmm. a scene, and then I never switch off the editor brain. I print mm-hmm. and I read it, and I hate it. And I go, this is so thin and clunky, and no one speaks that way. And I scribble all over it and type the changes and print it, and I read it, and I still hate it. And I'll do that about 6 times, and then the scene suddenly starts to take on life, mm-hmm. and I think, okay, now I can move on to the next one. Mm. So I guess if I do think of a reader, I'm thinking of one ideal person who is just going to love hearing this story.
Mm. And then how do you go with the editing process if you have so rigorously self-edited?
I still have... That's my second favourite part. Love editing, because it's like if you've made a sculpture and it, you know, it's in pretty good shape and you can see the figure, the editing is when you get to really fine-tune it and really find what was hidden inside the marble. And I love that. Mm. I would keep editing forever if I could, because that's when beautiful things happen, like you realise you can get rid of an entire scene if you insert one line in a later chapter, you know, and that is very satisfying. I loved maths at school as well as English, so I'm quite a mix. And I think I find that structural part, the architecture, very satisfying as well. Mm. And finding exactly the word that I mean. Mm. You know, I do a lot of lists of thesaurus, you know, which way, because often I'm trying to find a word I know and can't remember. Mm. And think, which one is it? That one, that's exactly what I mean.
Mm. Do you sleep with a notebook by your bed, or is on the phone?
I should, because I always do that thing that every writer does. Oh, I'll remember. Yeah. And then you wake up and go, what?
Yeah. ladies and gentlemen, we are going to take some questions. So I think there will be a microphone brought to the centre here. So if you want to start mulling your questions, there will be some questions very shortly. In terms of the portrayal of all these different characters, and I mean, it's quite a complex thing to be jumping from time and place all the time. How do you sort of keep hold of all those threads? And in Homecoming in particular, is there I mean, obviously Jess is the protagonist, she sort of pulls it all together, but how do you sort of keep all those threads so you know, artfully meshed together until the very end? I imagine that's quite a complex thing to do.
Yeah, for me, that is... I suppose I was alluding to that earlier when I said about the genre choosing the writer. That just is the way it's intuitive for me. That's the way I think. And except for The Forgotten Garden, where I very consciously wanted a tripartite plaited structure, and I was so rigorous with that in the beginning, where it had to be these 3 timelines, one after the other, that only in the editing stage did I loosen it up a little in order to help with the flow of story. But generally, I write in the order that you reach the pages in the book, and I can just tell when I need to move into the past or back to the present, and I find that helps to keep the layers tied together.
And do you think much about the sort of inner psychology of a character from, say, the 50 or the 1850s compared to a, you know, 2018 Jess in London? How do you sort of get inside the brains of these characters in different times and places?
Yeah, I mean, that's part of what the research is. Some of the most fruitful research can be reading primary texts, like diaries, you know, to read in the actual... The parlance, the written word of someone from the period is really useful. When I was writing Homecoming, because my character, Daniel Miller, writes his true crime book in 1959, I found it really useful. I actually went to the Trove, the online Trove, through the library, and pulled up all of the newspaper reports, and I traced through, say, the Somerton Man case, And I found not only was it interesting to learn, there was a lot to learn in terms of police procedure and how it was reported, but also the language, the use of Mr. So-and-so and, you know, those sorts of things. Mm. And it is a very helpful way of getting inside the world, the worldview that might inform that your characters have.
Sort of like method acting for writers.
It is just like that. Yeah, sometimes I'll find myself pulling the faces and the postures that I'm trying to describe. Jeez, that's why the door has to be shut.
Okay, so we'll go to some audience questions. Before we go, there's a statement that from the Adelaide Writers' Week, which I'll read you, which is that Adelaide Writers' Week has a zero tolerance to racism and disrespectful language. If you're asking a question at the microphone, we ask you to keep it civil and remember it's a question. I'm sure you'll all be very well behaved, but first question, let's see how we go.
Okay, thank you, Kate. You're amazing. The way you speak is so... I'm assuming that's how you write. You know, that's amazing. Would you say that... writing a novel is a bit like giving birth to a child?
In many ways. And, you know, whenever someone asks me how long does it take to write a book, the answer is about 9 months. And I always balk to say it because it just invites such an obvious comparison. But it is, particularly because it's something that is all yours and then you have to send it out there into the world and hope that it meets people who are kind to it and who understand it and all of those things that you also wish for your children.
What's that moment like when you send the book out into the world? How do you...
It's great because, I mean, I love writing and I would write whether I were published or not, but the public... part of publication means that someone else is involved. And for me, it is one of the most joyous parts of it. It doesn't matter how many readers there are. It's this incredible fact that I write a version of the book and I know the characters and the setting and the story. And then one other person picks it up and reads it and filters it through their own palette of experiences. And it turns into a unique version of itself. And I love that two minds have met through time and space in order to create this whole new, unique version of this story. That is such a privilege to get to do this for a living. So thank you for reading.
Next question, thank you.
Hi, I have a question as someone who's also in the middle of too many things and my brain is split between, so I've never actually finished a novel. I've finished a lot of plays and had them staged, but every time I've tried to finish a novel I just fail. How do you sustain, given that you have that tendency to branch off, how do you sustain long enough to get to the end of something?
It takes a time. Long form projects are so difficult, and I commend you that you have finished plays and had them put on. That is still ahead of me. I started in the world of drama, so I love that. It really is just fronting up every day and keeping on going. The middle is tricky, you know, it's the messy middle, because you've had the excitement of the first 20 to 30,000 words where you're bringing everyone on stage and you're, setting up the drama. And then there's this middle section where they have to do things and they have to do them for so long before you reach, you know, the denouement. And that is the hardest part. So push through. If a scene idea for something that happens later on comes to you, write that. You know, keep doing that. I started using Scrivener, which allows you to write out of order. I had always written in order, but I found that quite... if you're a visual person, you can move things around. So perhaps a program like that would help.
Next question, thank you.
Yeah, sorry, this was actually my question. Like, I got caught out a little bit by being too...
That's all right.
..too double-guessing myself. The process of interweaving the history and contemporary to get that spark. What's the process of doing that? How do you... can you speak into that a little?
Well, do you mean having a contemporary and a historical storyline per se?
No, not necessarily having a storyline. Taking a historical event or a person,
yep,
and connecting them with a current thinking, I suppose.
Yeah, it's... so I think I'm understanding. So I'll pick an historical period that I'm interested in, but many of the ideas that interest me, because I am a person living in 2024, are our issues, but often they, you can find ways to relate them. For instance, I was listening to a podcast recently with a social psychologist who was talking about the way people had started to feel that they couldn't say what they wanted to say because they might be being recorded at any time in our day and age. And so people were watching their words and being careful. And because I've been reading about the sort of Cold War period, I immediately saw it's a quite an obvious link to make, but I saw that you know, it's a type of decentralized authoritarianism almost. And so those things for me are sparks of interest that make me think, oh, I wonder if I can do something by writing about a contemporary interest in an historical setting.
Thank you.
Thank you. As a start.
The microphone is free. If anyone has any questions, please jump up. In the meantime, I meant to ask you this earlier when we were talking about your crafting of characters. In The Clockmaker's Daughter, one of your central characters is actually a ghost, which I thought was a marvellous thing to do. Can you tell us how you came to that? Did you start with a non-ghost character and then it became a ghost? I'm just fascinated as to how that came about.
Because I write books with characters in different, you know, there's often something that happened in the past and someone in the present, there's a constant challenge in working out, now, how old does, if I had someone alive when that happened, how old will they be now? 112. Ooh, is that doable? maybe. No, that's not plausible. You know, so I often have to work out ways to tell stories set in particular periods. And I wanted to set part of the historical part of The Clockmaker's Daughter in the pre-Raphaelite period. And that did not reach to the present day, unfortunately. And The Clockmaker's Daughter has numerous historical periods because it's centred in a house in England that sits within a bend of the River Thames, very much based on William Morris's country house, which I adore. And I wanted to write a book where we had the one setting, but I love that sense that within an old house, many lives have come in and out the door and been led. And I wanted to tell the story of this terrible thing that had happened there back in the pre-Raphaelite period when a group of artists went and had a wild and crazy time. But then also the people who've been there since. And I wanted to weave the story through. And so I needed some sort of continuity and some sort of connection. So although, I mean, it's not a ghost story in the traditional sense, I thought, can I do this? And I thought, yeah, why not? Why not tell the story in this way? And so we have lots of different historical periods throughout time leading up to the present day.
I mean, it's a very sort of bold move, isn't it, to have a ghost as a character?
Yeah, but it felt true to the spirit of my books. So I, you know, I went with it.
It worked beautifully. We have another question. Thank you.
Hi, Kate. I listened to your book actually as an audio book and had quite a surreal experience because I was driving a number of times up to that area, to Lobethal, and actually listening to you, the setting as I was kind of driving through it. So that was interesting. My question is, do you plot out the whole novel from beginning to end and know exactly how it's going to work out, or sometimes does that go in a different direction?
Yeah, I do. I'm always open to better ideas if they come along. But I find the best metaphor I can think of is a sculpture metaphor. So once when I went to see the statue of David, you know, in the Academia, you walk down a central corridor and there are unfinished sculptures. And I find them almost more interesting because it really is like the figure is emerging from the marble. But that's an aside. My point is I do sketch it all out, but in a very rough way. It's enough for me. I can see what's going to be beneath the shape. But if I had to scribble it down for someone, it really would just be the shape. I need to know what the twist is going to be. I do a lot about who the characters are. I used to concentrate most on plot, and the more I've written, the more I see that character is fate, as Heraclitus says. You know, everything stems from being true to who the character is, and so the inevitability of the outcome only works if it's true to what the character would have done, their fatal flaw or whatever the case may be. So I do lots of work at the beginning on the setting, the place. I need to know what the house is called, the family, what their names are, why their names are that, what happened, if the mother ran off with why and in what year and who are their extended friends and family. And some of this may never make it into the book, but it's so real for me. And I know what the ending will be and what the settings will be and what I want the twists to be along the way. And I have snippets of scenes, but as I said, if something better comes up, and it always does, and it colours and brightens along the way, of course, I go with that. But you get good at having faith that you've got enough to build a story.
And have you drawn on your own family history and your own background for some of your plots?
Yeah, I have. In The Forgotten Garden, my husband's family actually came to Australia from Sweden. Mm-hmm. And my husband's mum is a very good storyteller, and she tells stories many times, and so they become almost folkloric. Mm-hmm. And one of the stories she would tell is about this family of Swedes who travelled to Australia, and there was the mother was pregnant and ill on the boat, and she had lots of children. I think there were 6 or 7 children all running about the decks. And I start to see this in a very visual way with their white dresses and their sun hats. And one of the little girl's sun hat flew off. I can't tell now how much of this is her story or my invention of it. Her sun hat flew off into the water and she died from sunstroke on the way. And this imprinted on me, this picture of this little girl and the dresses and the hair and the hat and the water and the sparkle and the arrival in Australia. So that found its way. If you've read The Forgotten Garden, opens with a little girl who's been put on a boat by a stranger who she knows only as the authoress and finds herself in Maryborough, mm-hmm. in Queensland, with nothing but a little white suitcase with a book of fairy tales inside. And that was very much drawn from this family story.
Okay, how wonderful. Kate, you've been very generous with your time. If there's no more questions, I was going to ask if you might finish with a small reading for us.
I can certainly do that if there's no more questions. I'm never quite sure what to read because I haven't done a lot of readings, and I did a podcast recently and she asked for a reading and I read it. And as I was reading it, I had chosen a very dramatic scene at the beginning, which is where my character Percy, it's 1959, it's Christmas Eve in the Adelaide Hills, it's hot, it's a day like today. Mm. He's riding his horse back. He's been riding all day long, trying to reach his family, and he stops to let his horse have a drink and a swim in the creek. And he comes upon a terrible scene. This is the crime scene that opens the whole book. And I was reading this on the podcast, and as I was reading it and being recorded, I was starting to really psych myself out because I was going, this is very grim. And I did not set this up for the people at all. So these lovely listeners are here expecting, a description of a house or something, and instead they're getting this terrible, terrible, grim scene. So I'm not sure whether to inflict that on you or not.
Well... Oh, they what say, if the, yeah, the crowd says,
I
yes,
like
we want
this.
Australian Gothic, give it to us to end Writers Week on a dark note.
All right, well, having set it up, I feel a little bit better about it. And I will tell you that the chapter's quite long, and Percy is the character's name, and it does, the first line, which I'll then skip to the end, is later, when he was asked about it, as he would be many times over the course of his long, long life, Percy Summers would say truthfully that he thought they were asleep. So that's the first line. So it is set up for you that something is going to be found that is not as innocent as that sounds.
Sorry, I sprang that on Kate. We talked about it briefly beforehand.
And I'm just going to put reading glasses on just so I don't have to hold it at 2 arms length. Okay. The sleeping children, he remembered thinking, looked like the etchings in his mother's precious family Bible, brought with her grandparents when they emigrated from Liverpool. Beautiful children they were, even the boy, John, blonde curls. I should set the scene up. I was going to keep going, but I see that I have to. He's been riding. He is on his horse. The horse is having a swim. And he's come upon the grounds of this beautiful old house. The house is up hidden behind a copse of trees. And down on the edge of where the fence runs is the creek and willows along it. And as he's there, and he's sort of come, it's not his land, but he's let the horse in. And he looks up, and under one of the trees, he sees someone has strung some flags, and there's what he thinks is the scene of a family picnicking fast asleep. So the way, you know, a day like today. Hot, drowsy. Beautiful children they were, even the boy, John. Blonde curls like their father must have had when he was a child, and striking sea blue eyes, all except the eldest girl, Matilda, whose dark hair and green eyes made her the spitting image of her mother. He knew Matilda a little. She'd been in Kurt's class at school since they were small, and lately the two had become sweet on one another. She was lying in the shade nearest the tree trunk, her straw hat on the ground beside her. The warm wind ruffled the hem of her skirt. Her feet were bare. The other two children were on the blanket with their mother, wearing trunks with towels wrapped around their middles as if to dry off. John was on his back, while the girl, Evie, was curled up on her side, her right arm outstretched. Percy was reminded of the many times he'd taken his boys swimming in the creeks and lakes of the hills, but also down at the beach to Port Wollunga and Goolwa and the other places that his own father had taken him when he was a boy to fish and hunt for pippies. He could almost feel the happy post-swim drowsiness that came from having sun-dried skin. An old-fashioned wicker crib hung from the straightest bough of the willow. It was Meg who told him that Mrs. Turner had finally been delivered. They'd just come in from church a month or two before, and she'd stopped at the hall mirror to unpin her hat and straighten her hair. "Did you hear that Mrs. Turner's had her baby?" she'd called after Percy, who was by then in the kitchen filling the kettle. "Tiny little thing with a serious face." "That right," Percy had answered. "That's four now, and better her than me," Meg had said with a laugh. "Never let yourself get outnumbered, that's my motto." He'd since seen Mrs. Turner in town. A couple of weeks ago, she'd been carrying the babe in her arms, and he'd nearly knocked them over on his way out of the shop. He'd coloured with embarrassment, but she'd smiled at him as if it were no inconvenience at all to be trampled. To see Mrs. Turner lying there on the blanket now made Percy's cheeks burn as if he'd crept up on purpose. There was an intimacy to the setup beneath the willow, a vulnerability. Here was a family asleep together, evidence of their lunch still laid out haphazardly on the blanket between them, plates and cups, sandwich crusts and crumbs of cake. The stillness of the scene struck him then. It was almost unnatural. He took his hat from his head. Afterwards, he would wonder what it was precisely that made him do so. He was aware of the sound of his own breath, in and out, in and out. Something was moving on the younger girl's wrist, he noticed. He took a careful step closer. And that's when he saw the line of ants crawling straight across her body, over her arm, and on towards what was left of the picnic food. Everything else was static, silent. No one's features twitched in sleep. No one yawned and readjusted as the breeze grazed their skin. Not a single chest lifted or lowered. He went to Mrs. Turner and knelt beside her head. Dampening his finger, he held it near her nose, willing it to cool with an exhalation. He realized that his finger was shaking. He looked away into the middle distance as if that might somehow help him, as if by concentrating his senses he could force her to breathe. Nothing. There was nothing. Percy backed away. He stumbled over the lunch basket, flinching at the jarring noise of cutlery and crockery clanking together. Still no one stirred, not one of them so much as moved a muscle. With trembling hands, Percy jammed his hat back on his head. He tried to stop his thoughts from racing, tumbling, colliding with one another. Realization, shock, fear. he tried to clear his head of the lot of them so he could work out what should happen next. Blaise was nearby, and without another moment's hesitation, Percy grabbed her reins and found his way into the saddle, urging her onwards in search of help.
Thank you for sharing that, and to follow the twists and turns and to find out who done it, you really have to go to the book tent and purchase a copy of Homecoming. Kate, unfortunately, has to leave, so won't be sticking around for signings, but she has very generously pre-signed copies of the book, which are available over at the Quick Tent. So please join me in thanking Kate and
thank you.
The best for the rest of your evening and the Writers' Week.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you, Kate.
I promise if there's a book club, you'll be the first to know.
You can keep it a secret. It's okay.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you for coming.